1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Friday the 13th. You may only see it once, but that will be enough. Friday the 13th, rated R.
Now playing at Man Westwood, Man's Hollywood, and a theater near you.
Hello, and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week is one of the co-hosts of Marvel's Secret Wars and Beyond podcast, Sean Ross. Hi, Sean.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. I'm excited to be here.
I am very happy to have you here. Now, okay, we're here to talk about the original Friday the 13th from 1980, which is, of course, the first of approximately 19 Friday the 13th films that they produced at this point. The reason I wanted to have Sean on, first of all, of course, as you're listening to this, Friday the 13th is just around the corner. And anytime Friday the 13th rolls around, I like to have something related to that date. But also, Sean was a guest on Ryan's It's Midnight, the Podcasting Hour podcast, where he told this amazing story, his childhood story about him and Friday the 13th. Now, normally, I wouldn't make Sean repeat the story. I would just play the clip from Ryan's show. But the licensing rights from Ryan's shows are exorbitant. It's like getting a Beatles tune. It's just ridiculous. So, Sean, if you don't mind, would you please relate that story once again of the traumatic experience between you and this movie?
Yeah, I'm so glad that my childhood trauma is bringing joy to so many. It's a nice moment
it's
for
all
me.
If you're a podcaster, it's all grist for the mill.
There you go. So, yeah, I have an interesting experience with this movie in that it is the first horror movie I ever saw in my lifetime, and that would be because I was 5 years old when it came out. And so I was five. I have two older sisters who are now wonderful women, but were evil devil spawn when they were younger. They are 6 and 7 years older than me, and they had concocted this plan with some friends of theirs to sneak in to see Friday the 13th. So they tell my mom, hey, we're going to a movie. My mom takes one look at them, and she must have known something was up, and she's like, okay, you're taking your little brother. And they, you know, kind of hemmed and hawed. She's like, no, you're taking your little brother. So I'm like, yay, I get to go hang out with my sisters. I get to go to a movie thinking, you know, Fox and the Hound is out, or, you know, Sword in the Stone or some other Disney movie that will not scar me for life. And so they're like, okay, we're going. And we go to this theater, and I told this story on the podcast with Ryan, and actually after telling the story, I was like, how did they get into the movie? Because this is an R-rated film, and they were only 12 and 13. So it turns out we grew up in a small town in Oregon. And in this small town, the theater was run by a family, and the kid went to junior high with my sisters. So apparently, if you went up to this theater and you said, I'm friends with Kevin, they would let you into the theater, and you just had the run of the place. So my sister – yeah, I know, right? Seriously, small town America. So my sisters go in. They say they're friends with Kevin. They were meeting these other kids there. They take me in to see Friday the 13th, and I'm asking my sister, like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, what is this movie? Is it scary? Am I going to be scared? She's like, no, shut up. Don't ruin it for us. And I'm like, you know, yeah, that's her big concern, right? That I'm going to ruin their big junior high date moment. And I'm like, no, I don't want to see this. I don't want to see this. And she's like, shut up. She's like, just sit in the chair and we'll cover your eyes. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so I literally pull up into this huge theater chair, like total crouched in a fetal position. I cover my eyes, and then at one point I pull my sister's hand over my eyes and I try to get her to also cover my ears because this is the scariest damn movie ever made, and the music in particular is horrifying. So as you can imagine, like, this is a scary enough movie already, but it's even scarier seen through somebody's fingers. Like, you're only getting these snippets of what's happening. And I, to this day, have really vivid memories of this movie, and now in rewatching it, scenes that never happened that were burned into my mind that I thought had happened. But so we see the movie. Somehow I survive. We go back home, and my sisters are threatening me the entire walk home. And they're like, you're not telling mom. Do not tell mom what you saw. Do not tell mom we met boys there. And I'm like, okay. So we go back. You know, the night unfolds. I go to bed. And, you know, some point in the middle of the night, I wake up screaming, convinced that some person, perhaps my own mother, might be stalking me, ready to kill me. And exactly, right? I had one of those like little Fisher-Price radios next to my bed, and I think that might have been what was playing out of it. So I get up and I go running into my mom's room, And I'm like, Mom, I'm scared. And she's like, what is going on with you? Like, you're too old for this. You haven't woken up in the middle of the night in years. So I just confess everything. And she goes and she shakes my sisters awake. And she is like, you took your five-year-old brother to see a movie called Friday the 13th? She didn't even know. Like, she didn't know what this movie was. She just figured it out. And they, you know, apologize. And she's like, oh, you're doing more than apologizing. You are raising him through this. She's like, you are now his mother's. And you are raising him until he is no longer scared to sleep at night. And I'm talking a good couple months of me being scared to like take a shower without wanting them sitting outside the bathroom door, or you know, walk down a dark hallway without wanting that one of them going and turning the light on ahead of me. Now, I was a little brother, so I took full advantage of this as well, and I made them, you know, my little valets for a couple months. But yeah, those like evil women took me to see Friday the 13th at 5 years old because they had sixth grade boy dates. So super awesome family.
That is, it's just remarkable. I have so many questions. One is like, did you have an adversarial relationship with your sisters, or did you see no, when you were a kid, like, did you just trust them implicitly?
Oh yeah, totally. So my family's really close, and I was raised by my mom and my sisters. So my sisters really are my sort of surrogate moms. So they have always cared for me. So there was not a question in my mind that we were going on some fun escapade that was, you know, tailored to me, especially because when we got there, like, they bought me popcorn. And I was like, whoa, I get a popcorn to myself? Like, and I was like, oh, I was in heaven. And I thought, you know, this is so cool. And I'm hanging out with these big kids. And they totally – and I've asked them as adults, I was like, what was going through your mind? Like, at any point on that walk to the theater, did you look at each other and say, hey – maybe we shouldn't take the five-year-old to the slasher flick? And they were like, no, we were way too concerned with how we looked and who was meeting us. And they're like, honestly,
wow.
Yeah. And they've since apologized, but they totally, in a completely selfish, like, adolescent egocentrism moment, they totally sacrificed me to the altar of like PG folders with boys' names on them. Like, it was just, I was not a factor at all.
That's amazing. I think my favorite part of the story, too, is that your mom showed amazing creativity and resourcefulness by, you know, I mean, most parents probably would have just punished her daughter. She would have been like, but no, it was like, you're going to take this kid through this journey that you started him on. That's like amazingly creative of your mom.
It is the resourcefulness of the single mom, man. I'm telling you. Yeah. And my sisters, and I can't emphasize this enough. Like, I'm laughing while I'm telling you this story. But I was full on scarred by this. In fact, I had not watched this movie again until I watched it to prep for this podcast, because it has lived in my horror headcanon as this like giant monster that I can't look too closely at. So it was really funny, because when you suggested this movie, I was like, oh, I better have my therapist on speed dial. Like, I don't know if I can do that. And it actually turned out to be a really fun experience, but it was so funny to talk to my sisters again and revisit the story. And, you know, 5 years old, like, some of my primal memories of early life are a sense memories of sitting in the chair with my hands like pushed into my face because I was so scared. And oh my God, the music in that movie. So every time every time that would start, it would just trigger a panic in me again. So yeah, this was, when you suggested this movie, I was like, man, okay, full circle, going back to some primal kid fears here. But yeah, those are that's my evil older sisters, and you can tell where their priorities lie.
That's amazing. And I appreciate the sacrifice you were willing to make for this podcast is to watch this movie again. A little bit of backstory of this film. Obviously, it was directed by Sean Cunningham, and it was a movie that he basically built out of nothing. He ran an ad in, I think it was Variety or whatever, was like the Hollywood Reporter, and it just had the title, Friday the 13th, and he had nothing else except that. And out of that, he found funding, because a studio was like, well, that seems like a really great idea. And they basically put this film together. So it was really kind of done in that Roger Corman huckstery style of like, well, we have a great title. There's never been a movie called that, and it's going to be a horror movie. And, you know, 13 is unlucky, so there we go. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And the movie was made on a measly budget of $550,000. It went on to gross almost $60 million. In 1980 money, which is just absurd of how well it did. I mean, so this thing, and then, you know, it of course spawned a beyond legion of imitators. And I will say, this movie, I watched it again, like you. I watched it again, although not with my hands over my eyes. I watched it again after having seen it many years ago, because I was like, well, over time, this film has gained something of a reputation as like a classic, partly just because it's old, and the imitators that have followed it are such garbage for the most part, either the sequels themselves or the, you know, the myriad other movies where it's a guy slashing teenagers. So I was kind of settled in to say, well, geez, maybe this movie isn't that bad because, you know, it's over time, it's gained a cachet. And before I get to what I thought about this movie, I mean, I don't even think I need to explain the plot to anybody. Basically, it opens up in the 50s where these two camp counselors are about to have sex. They get murdered. And then we cut to we flash forward to 21 years later, and it's Friday the 13th, and this camp, Camp Crystal Lake, is about to be reopened. And a bunch of camp counselors show up, and then, of course, they start being killed off one by one, and we have to figure out who, you know, who is it that's doing this. So, Sean, like, what was your take on Friday the 13th after having not seen it in decades?
So once I was able to unclench my fist from my eyes as I, you know, when I watched it this time, I was surprised. I was really surprised by how completely unscary this movie is.
Yes.
It missed its mark because it should have been a comedy. I mean, it is so bad that it's laughably bad in moments. And I, you know, I'll be really honest with you. I was watching it and I'm taking notes as I'm watching. I'm taking notes, you know, because I know we're going to be talking about it. And all of a sudden, all my notes are turning into like, oh my God, can Annie just die soon? Like, would you please right. just kill Annie? And like, Ned needs to die. And I just, all my notes are like, you know, counting the minutes till he's dead. Counting
oh,
the minutes.
Did I hate Ned? Oh my God, did I hate Ned?
Oh my, the character. So my overall impression, before we, I guess, dive into the beautiful details that make up the blanket that is Friday the 13th, it is hung together on, I can't even call it a plot. Like it's just a series of scenes, except they are clearly not fully finished. And actually, in my research about the movie, they were pretty open to the fact that the script wasn't done, that they would get rewrites like minutes before they would shoot. And you can see it in certain scenes, like the scene where Ned's about to die. He's like kind of wandering around and he's kicking rocks and he's looking around. And I swear to God, you can hear the director from the side going, Ned, basically your motivation here is just waiting till we kill you. Like just act like you're about to die, but you don't know you're about to die. So he's clearly sitting there and you can even see him thinking like, do to do. Now I walk up the stairs. Now I walk in the door. Now I turn left. And it's so bad. And then by the end, it is a surprisingly long movie. Like this was a movie that, I mean, this is like, it's kind of like On the Road by Jack Kerouac. Like it needed an editor. Like we could have done.
What a comparison. Wow.
We could have done with about 45 minutes less of this movie. And I think it would have been much tighter, much scarier, much funnier inadvertently. But it's by the time you get to the end and you get to the twist at the end, it's like, yeah, okay, that's interesting. But it is not a good film. And I'm going to stake my claim right at the top that if it is not for the music, if it is not for Henry Manfredini's, if it's not for that sound effect, this movie's not famous. This movie doesn't make any money, and it's not urban legend. It is just because of that specific sound, which is apparently some sort of primal sound you hear when you're about to be murdered.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation with the music. I agree. I think that the music is by far the most famous thing to come out of this movie. And I remember a bunch of years ago when I was a kid and I was on vacation in the Poconos, which of course everybody knows I talk about over on my Mountain Comic Show. There was one year where my parents, some friends of my parents were visiting at a cabin at the same time. And they had two sons, one of which was like a year older than me and one was like 2 years younger. So we hung out. And while we were hanging out, just, you know, going on the boat, visiting, going on the lake and doing all these different things, we met a bunch of girls that were also staying. And we were all out sitting around a campfire. And, of course, you know, like I was of the age of like I knew I was interested in girls, but I had no facility to do anything about it. Actually, nothing much has changed. But that's
I was going to say, what age does that end at?
Like, yeah, I was 37. All right. I admit it. But at one point, like just to be cheeky, I went, and the girls were absolutely terrified by that music. And I didn't know of the power of just being in the dark around a campfire in a forest going ch-ch-ch, and it, you know, even though they knew I was the one doing it, they were like really creeped out by it because that music is so famous. And I agree. I think this movie is a thudding bore. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is just the only actor you really kind of pay any attention to, and that's just because you know he's from other things, is Kevin Bacon. You know, you're just like, oh, wow, there's Kevin Bacon in this kind of cheesy movie. But I just, this thing is like a video game, you know, where it's just one person just gets bumped off after the next. None of the scenes, I think, are particularly well staged or interesting. You know, I mean, the only part I kind of enjoyed is that the character that makes it through to the end is not the one you think is going to make it through. Like, she, you know, it's like Alien. It's like, oh, wow, Sigourney Weaver is the lead of this movie. I didn't know that. And so the character that makes it at the end is like, she was one of the ones I would have pegged to die early on, but she makes it through. But, yeah, like Ned is so annoying. I was like, oh, please kill this guy. Mm-hmm. He's just, he's not funny. Yeah, like, I really think the reason this movie survived, as you said, the music, and just because there have been so many slapdash versions since that this movie looks good in retrospect, but if you watch it as an artifact, to me, I'm like, this is just tedious, this thing.
It is so bad, and the characters are so one note. I mean, it's like they all showed up on the same day, and they said, Ned, you're the funny, annoying one. Alice, you're the sort of virginal one. You know, Marcy and Jack, you're the, you know, sexually charged ones. And that's all the direction they gave them, and it is, like you said, it is a flat, boring movie, and there's a lot of time between killings. Like, considering this is what this movie hangs its hat on, you know, you would think that there would be more attention paid to pacing and to the building of tension. That's actually probably my biggest complaint about this film, is that it has no idea how to build tension. You know, it's that old thing about two characters are sitting at a cafe and they know there's a bomb under the table versus two characters sitting at a cafe and they don't know there's a bomb under the table. And one of them is filled with tension and one of them is not. And they had no idea how to do that, even to the point where, again, some of the deaths are so – Ned's death in particular, he's like just wandering part of the camp and he sees somebody and he's like, oh, hey, do you need help? And then it just cuts away and you hear music and you're like, oh, did he just die? Like, okay. I guess I'll mourn him. Like, I don't know. Am I supposed to? And it really is. I like your video game analogy in that, you know, it is kind of one little boss fight after another that you keep losing because everybody keeps dying. But it's an NPC. It's a non-playable character who makes it through to the end. I mean, Alice, like, Alice is the rice cake of main characters. Like, she just, there's nothing to her. And I could not – when I was like, oh, wait, she's the one who survives? I had totally not remembered this because, again, through my fingers when I saw it when I was five, the only scenes I vividly remembered were the end when Jason pops up and grabs her in the sort of dream sequence. And then I had actually imagined a scene. So when Brenda is at the archery – she's setting up the archery part and Ned fires that arrow dangerously close to her and you're like, oh, ha-ha, Ned, psycho. I actually remembered her dying in that scene. So I was surprised when she didn't because my five-year-old brain remembered her like getting hit and like clutching the archery thing. And I was like, oh, okay, interesting. So I had some interesting fantasies, I guess, or I filled in some interesting gaps when I was five. But it's just a string of poorly written, poorly acted moments all counting on you being so bowled over by the quote surprise ending that it doesn't hold together at all. And I am actually very surprised that it's considered a classic. And I was surprised in rewatching it how often I laughed versus how often I was scared, which I don't know that I was scared again when I rewatched it.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think it's one of those things where it's just times change and we just get used to certain things where, like, in 1977, Star Wars was considered so fast-paced as to be almost incoherent by modern critics. You know, a lot of older critics were like, this movie goes too fast. And now, Star Wars seems leisurely paced.
Oh, yeah.
Compared to, like, a Michael Bay film, which has, you know, 75 cuts in 35 seconds. But, you know, you watch Star Wars now, and you're like, oh, my God, this thing is just – I mean, it's great, but it really takes its time. But you mentioned the amount of space between the kills in this movie, and I think that's what makes it seem more legit than it really is, because it's like, oh, they actually bother to like establish characters. It's not just a kill fest. Yeah, but you're not interested in any of the characters.
No, not at all.
None of the performances are any good. None of the characters are particularly interesting. The movie, by bringing in, spoiler alert, the villain at the end, where, of course, you know, this movie, Jason is not the killer in this movie. It's his mother, mm-hmm. played by Betsy Palmer. She shows up at the very end of the movie, and we're like, oh, she's the killer, which is a complete cheat. Like, you can't bring in the killer at the end of your movie. You can't bring in a character at the end of your movie and be like, oh, she's the one who did it. They couldn't even have, like, one scene of her in the beginning that would have, like, okay, well, there was that character at the beginning. Oh, she's the one who did it. But it's like, well, you can write any mystery you want if you bring in the killer at the very end of the movie. I mean, that's easy to write, you know? It's like, come on. So that, like, and the scenes of Betsy, like, Betsy, apparently they offered the role to a lot of actresses,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to get Estelle Parsons, which is, like, absurd. Estelle Parsons was, like, this Oscar-winning actress who had been in Bonnie and Clyde and was working with Warren Beatty. She's not going to do this piece of junk movie. Betsy Palmer is not good in this movie. She's not particularly well. And the scene of her chasing the characters at the end are just, like, poorly. I was really, like, really?
Yeah.
This thing? Yeah, like, wow.
I had an entire moment when, you know, the reveal comes that she's the bad guy. And I had kind of forgotten that, to be honest with you, because, you know, you automatically associate Friday the 13th with Jason and the hockey mask. And I'd forgotten that he doesn't really appear in the first one, and the hockey mask doesn't make an appearance at all. So when she shows up and you know, she's the villain, I was like, oh, no, this older woman is going to stalk me and kill me. Like, I looked at Alice and I looked at her and I was like, hey, Alice, you've got like 50 years on her. Like, I'm pretty sure you can take her. Like, I didn't find her scary or intimidating. Like, I just kept watching going, yeah, this feels like a Depends commercial that went really wrong. Like, I don't know why. I don't understand why she's supposed to be intimidating. And I will say, I will give her a little bit of credit. The moments when she cuts into Jason's voice and is like, kill her, mommy. I was like, okay, you know, and I think I just had a little bit of, I don't know, Stockholm syndrome from how bad the rest of the movie was that I was like, oh, that was somewhat interesting. Like there was a little bit of writing, like, okay, there was a character choice that was made, and that's maybe one more choice than was made in the entire film combined. So, okay, she hears the voice of her dead son. There, we can go with that. But I couldn't believe that she was supposed to be, you know, the physical villain in the end. You know, it reminded me of, did you ever see The Firm? It's like, yeah, that sure. Last scene when Tom Cruise's big confrontation is with Wilfred frickin' Brimley. And you're like, oh, dude, you're like, this is the fight? Like, young action star Tom Cruise versus the face of diabetes? Like, I don't see that as a battle. And so, yeah, I had real – the movie is just so anticlimactic once you get to the end. And it's really ridiculous.
Yeah, I always know that I'm a movie's not holding my interest where I'm kind of getting distracted by other stuff that's going on and in the main plot. Like when we see Annie and she shows up at the diner, right? And she needs a ride and there's all these weird locals. Like in the background behind her, you see this big newsstand. And I'm like, oh, I wonder what comic books were on sale.
I did the same thing.
In 1980. I was like, you know, what is the Justice League? Or you can't see, it's all out of focus. But that's all I think about. I was like, oh, yeah, there's probably a bunch of comics back there. I would have been interested in that. That's kind of interesting. And, like, I know that this movie has a direct connection to my stomping grounds of New Jersey. Because, mm-hmm. Of course, Jason Voorhees is named after Voorhees, New Jersey, which is the next town over from here. It is also 8 miles away from Haddonfield, New Jersey, which was the inspiration for Halloween, which is, of course, that takes place in Haddonfield, Illinois, but it was named for Haddonfield, New Jersey, because Deborah Hill, one of the producers and writers of that movie, was from this area. So, and they said if you there's a documentary, Halloween 25 Years of Terror, you can show, so there's a picture of a road sign that lists Voorhees right under Haddonfield.
Mm-hmm.
The township is named for Foster McGowan Voorhees, the governor of New Jersey from 1899 to 1902. The surname Voorhees is of Dutch heritage and also a common family name in New Jersey. And on the guy's truck, the guy that takes Annie in, you see it says New Jersey on the side of his truck. And this was shot in a real camp in New Jersey, Camp Nobi Bosco, which is still in operation. And it sells apparently Friday the 13th paraphernalia.
That's the part that killed me. It's still in operation. It is a Boy Scout camp, and they got permission to film at it by making a big donation to the Boy Scouts. And I was like, not only does the Boy Scout camp allow this movie to be filmed there, but they actually celebrate it now. Like, I want to see, like, their paraphernalia. Does it say, like, no gay people, but Jason welcome? Like, what the hell is the Boy Scout – like, what are the Boy Scouts of America doing? Like, what choices are they making?
You got to have standards in the Boy Scouts.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah, like, God forbid. It's so crazy to me. When I read that, I was really shell-shocked. And then also, like, I have questions. I have legitimate questions. As a parent of an 8-year-old – I would not send my child to a Boy Scout camp where they filmed Friday the 13th. Like, sorry. There's got to be other places, you know, where they can make lanyards. Like, I'm not doing it.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably lots of movies that camps have been the subject of, and yeah, maybe not an R-rated adult movie. Again, R-rated horror movie is the one for it. There is one scene in this movie that I actually found. The gore doesn't gross me out, and it doesn't offend me. I mean, I like some movies, like especially like Italian horror. I really kind of like it when they really get into it. If it's done well, like somebody like Lucio Fulci kind of guys, like really, or Dario Argento. But like these kills are just kind of, I don't know. I think maybe the reason this was so famous again is that in 1980, that was still kind of new to for the camera to not pan away. Like when Annie gets her throat cut, we see it.
Yeah.
And, of course, the famous kill of Kevin Bacon where he gets spiked through the bed, we see it. They don't cut away. It's a full-on shot. And I guess maybe for kids looking for that kind of – like this movie was taking it up a notch because this was released by Paramount. I mean, this was a major studio film. Halloween looks demure, you know, in comparison. So maybe that was part of the reason this thing jumped out and made a mark. Again, aside from the music, is because – it really didn't pan away. Sean Cunningham just sticks the camera right in, you know, Kevin Bacon's neck as we see the spear go through him and stuff.
Yeah, and it's funny because they apparently – the MPAA or whatever it was called at that time took so much grief for allowing this movie through at an R rating that they actually forced them to tone down the gore in Friday the 13th Part 2. So it's actually apparently a much tamer movie than this one, which I thought was interesting. Yeah. I just don't think anybody thought that people would watch this. I mean, Betsy Palmer talks about when they offered her the role of Mrs. Voorhees, she tells a funny story where she was literally driving, her car breaks down, she gets back to her house, and her agent calls, and he's like, hey, I have a role. And she's like, how much does it pay? Because I need a new car. And she literally agrees to do the movie because she needs a new car. And when they send her the script and she realizes what kind of movie it is, she says to herself, and she says it in a pretty funny way in the interview, she's like, look, I almost turned it down, but then I was like, nobody's going to see this piece of junk, so I'm just going to do it and get my new car. And I was like, all right, I can admire that. That's interesting.
Every celebrity that has ever said that to themselves, I will do this piece of junk because no one's ever going to see it, that always backfires on them.
Oh, yeah.
Every single time. The guy from the guy that played the pilot in Plan 9 from Outer Space was like, no one's ever going to see this little movie. And then that's the only thing he's famous for, is Plan 9 from Outer Space. So I was like, if you, it's the same, I think the same rule applies where if you're an actor and you bring your friend to the audition,
oh yeah,
the friend is getting the part.
Yeah.
The friend is going to become a superstar. That is always the way to, so just don't do it. Just don't bring your friend. Just be like, I'll go, but wait in the car. Here, go see a movie. I'm going to go do this thing on my own. There is one scene in this movie that I wanted to mention because I actually was genuinely – I was talking about how the gore doesn't offend me. But there is one scene in this movie that I did find genuinely offensive, and I did not – I didn't remember it until then I watched it again, is when the snake
crawls
into the cabin and they literally kill a real snake. And we see it. We see the actor with a machete chop this snake into several pieces. And – you know, I mean, I don't think I'm being particularly righteous, but to me, it's like you do not kill other living things. You shouldn't do it anyway, but you especially shouldn't be doing it for a friggin' movie. Come on. And it sickened me when they do the close-up of the poor thing as it's still wriggling, as it's getting its head chopped off. Like that, I was like, oh, Lord, this is – no.
I was really surprised by that because I was like, is there an easier thing to fake on the planet than a snake?
You ain't
kidding. It just doesn't make any sense. You could have easily – any kid's toy box has a big plastic snake in it you could use to chop it. Yeah, and they zoom in you talking about not pulling away. It's Harry Crosby, Bing Crosby's son.
Oh, he must have been so proud. Oh, well, Bing was dead by this point, so maybe he didn't
yeah,
know.
I'm thinking on his deathbed, Bing Crosby was like Bells of St. Mary, you know, doing the little drummer boy duet with David Bowie, and that time my son was in Friday the 13th. Like, those are the things I'm going to take with me. But yeah, he chops the snake, and you like you said, you can see it wriggling. And I asked myself, because there are a couple scenes in particular in this film. One is the snake in the cabin scene, and then one is the Ned pretending to drown scene that they let go on way too long.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I kept asking myself, why are these scenes in this movie? Like, what are they are they is this their attempt at foreshadowing? Like, do they think they're setting a mood? And I thought, oh, okay, they're trying to establish that Ned is kind of a psycho, or they're trying to establish that, you know, Bing Crosby's son, whose character name I'm now forgetting. Oh, Bill.
They're
trying to establish that Bill, you know, he machetes this snake, and then he stands there looking kind of ominous and machete in his hand. And I was like, oh, they were trying to make you guess who the murderer is. Like, they think, and you joked about this earlier, but it's true. Like, they think this is a mystery. Like, they think we're actually wondering who's doing all the killing. But we're not, because there is no mystery. And then again, like you said, they just parachute the murderer in at the end, and that's not how mysteries work. Like, they couldn't have put her in the diner at the beginning. You know, they couldn't have just in the background, or
just looking spooky and stuff, just looking all like, whoa. Yeah. And you just would have been like, oh, tipped a little bit, like, oh, okay. I saw her in the opening part of the movie. Oh, I remember that. Yeah. That would have been funny if she literally parachutes in. That would have been great. Like, just do super meta and just literally have her drop in with a parachute.
That would have been a better movie, though. Like, it would have been an actual better movie if she just parachutes in, if they were just full on making fun of themselves. And so as I rewatched it, I was like, okay, who are they trying to lay the groundwork, you know, could be the killer? And I'm like, well, there's Crazy Ralph, who, you know, you're going to Camp Blood, huh? And I'm like, this ominous prophet of doom sounds like he's trying to sell you on a teddy bear at a garage sale. Like, I just don't – I did not buy him at all. And then they're like, okay, maybe it's Steve, the guy who runs the camp, because he has the exact same Jeep as Mrs. Voorhees. You're supposed to, like, maybe think it's him. And then I thought, oh, okay, they're trying to say maybe it's Bill. And then I just said, you know what? Forget it. Like, there is no internal consistency to this movie on any level. And people die. Like, Ned dies midday, and no one goes looking for him, or no one's concerned when it starts storming and he's nowhere to be seen. So it's just such a weird hodgepodge of moments that just never coalesces into a film.
That might be the most realistic part, is that nobody goes looking for Ned. You know, they're like, oh, thank God we got rid of this guy. We don't have to deal with him anymore. There is one positive thing I want to get to this movie, but before we mention that, there's a couple other data points I just think are funny. First of all, I love originally the character of Jason was called Josh.
Yeah.
Which, just like, I would love the idea of Friday the 13th, Josh Lives. Like, it just doesn't have that same kind of, like, scary element to it. It's like, oh no, Josh. Oh, yeah, he's not that scary. He's not that bad. And then this, I found this on IMDb. I love this data point that somebody wrote in the trivia, because this is just somebody desperate to write something on IMDb. Friday the 13th came out the same year as Ordinary People, and both were about a boy drowning and the disastrous impact this has on all the characters. Both also have a vindictive mother who unfairly punishes the people around her for the boy drowning. Yeah, sure. Okay, I mean, they're both movies, and they're both a series of still images projected at a speed to replicate movement, I guess. I mean, like, I'm like, who wrote that? That would make a great double feature, Ordinary People and Friday the 13th. They're thematically similar.
There's a through line. If you just pay attention, there's a through line that goes through both. Yeah, I had some small nitpicks about this film that I kind of couldn't get over. Like, apparently they didn't have a budget for bras. Like, there are more nipples in this movie than on a space prostitute. Like, I eventually, because I needed to entertain myself, I just started counting, and I'm like, okay, not wearing a bra, not wearing a bra, not wearing a bra. And well, yeah, I did little things to keep myself entertained. I also had a drinking game. Every time somebody said Camp Crystal Lake, or every time they showed a sign of it, I took a drink, and I was drunk for a week. Cause in the first 10 minutes alone, they established we are at Camp Crystal Lake 23 times. It's just totally ridiculous. Yeah, there's some really weird choices in this film. Every guy in the film when they go swimming is wearing a Speedo, because apparently Camp Crystal Lake is in Europe. Like, I don't know. I don't understand. I don't understand what some of the choices were. They don't add up to anything. And I'll be honest with you too. I got first 30 minutes, I found it all really funny and quaint and cute. And then when I kept looking at my, you know, at that Amazon Prime, and I kept looking at how much time was left in the film, I was like, really? Like, how is there possibly this much time left? And I couldn't believe how long they let some of those scenes go. It's just crazy.
Yeah. It's for a 95-minute movie, it feels at times endless.
Yeah.
But I do want to get to the part that I actually like, which is the ending. The ending of this movie. I mean, first of all, it gets there in a completely, like, what the F way, in that, you know, Annie survives the attack by Mrs. Voorhees. And, you know, she's almost killed, but she survives. And she decides at that moment, oh, okay, now's the time to take a leisurely canoe ride at night. okay, like I would think I would kind of run, you know, in the closest direction to the police as opposed to getting in a canoe. But okay, that's me. But the ending, the famous ending where we see that where she is, she wakes up the next morning. And it's like probably like 7 a.m. in the morning, and she's on the boat, and then the desiccated body of Jason, who is not – I mean, we know it's Jason because we've heard about him. We know that he drowned, and that's why Mrs. Voorhees is on this rampage, because the camp counselors who were busy screwing let her boy die. But he doesn't look like Jason. Christopher, first of all, it's like a dummy. It's not even like a real actor, because you could tell it's so tiny. And he doesn't have the face mask. Oh, you know, but you just know from the setup that it's Jason. But it happens, and then we find Annie at the hospital, and the cops tell her, there was no body. What are you talking about? We didn't find anybody like that. And she's like, then he's still out there. And then they just have this slow meditative shot of the lake. I like that ending because it was just like, huh?
Uh-huh.
What? Like, I kind of like the weirdness of it. After 93 minutes of, to me, very boring, plotting stuff, I liked just the sheer oddness of the ending, that it's unexplained. And you're like, well, wait, did she really get attacked by Jason? Is Jason still alive? Like, I liked that ambiguity, especially coming after a movie that just, to me, has very little imagination. So that ending, I genuinely liked. And in a weird way, I could almost see myself, if I had been, oh, I don't know, 5 years old and seeing Friday the 13th with my sisters, I would have been like, I maybe kind of want to see that's like where this goes, because the ending is, to me, really good. But it's not worth sitting through the 92 and a half minutes to get there.
No, not at all. And they added that kind of after. They said one of the producers had said to the director, you know, hey, we need a seat jumper ending. Like, we need something that gets people one more time just when they think they're safe. And so they went back and they filmed that scene. But the man who did the makeup, he it wasn't in the script. So he's like, well, I'm a great makeup artist. I'm not just going to have some kid jump through the water. He's like, I'm going to make him a mongoloid. And I'm going to make – and they made him so disturbing looking. And that actually – Betsy Palmer and people, the director, people had real problems with it afterwards. It was too late to fix it. But they were really upset with him, because they were like, no, it was supposed to be like a – you know, a kid who's clearly been underwater for a while, and you added this really bizarro element. But no, I agree. I liked it a lot. In fact, and in my, this is another scene I actually had invented in my 5-year-old brain. When Alice wakes up in the hospital, for some reason, I remembered it as no one believing her and her saying like, it wasn't a dream. It wasn't a dream. And then the cops like pushing her down and like sedating her. So I actually had a very different ending in my head from when I was a kid. So when I watched it again, I was like, oh, okay. Like, you know, people at least know what happened to her, and she can maybe get some help and she'll survive 5 minutes into the sequel. But, you know, that's about it. And I like it too, though. I thought it was a good – I agree with you. I didn't want to sit through the entire film to get there, but I thought it was probably the best moment in the film, and I could see how it's set up, you know, the sequels to come. It kind of reminds me – this is a much better version of this. But did you ever see the Blair Witch Project?
Oh, sure.
And that movie, you know, I went and saw it, and it had all the hype, you know, oh, it's the scariest movie ever made. And I have to say, I had almost a very similar experience where, like, I don't know, let's say it's a 90-minute movie. The first 85 minutes of that film, I was like, okay, this is super boring. This is super boring. But oh my God, that last 5 minutes, and especially the run into the house that you could barely see, I was like, oh my God, this is terrifying. I totally get it. So I think you're right. I think maybe the ending just carry the day and make this a classic in people's minds.
Right. And I mean, of course, you know, people, it's famous because there are so many movies in this franchise. I mean, anytime you spend $50,000 and you make $60 million, you're going to make more of these. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. I've always heard things about Sean Cunningham and that supposedly he's kind of like a very gentle kind of soul, and he, you know, happened to make this movie kind of on a lark, and then it pegged him as the horror guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he always wanted to do other things but never got the opportunity. I don't know whether that's true or not. I don't mean to run the guy down. If you look at his filmography, there's not a lot there that suggests that he is some Kubrickian talent laying under the surface, and he was just thwarted by Friday the 13th success. But maybe he was. I mean, maybe that's the exact thing. Maybe he never really got a chance to do much else. I don't know. But yeah, this film, I just found it to be pretty grim going. I will relate the one other interesting story that I have to Friday the 13th, because it's related to one of the later films, and I'm never going to cover it on the show, so why not talk about it here? And I will give a very brief version, because it's not really all that funny, is that me and my friend Doug Slack, my oldest friend from junior high, we've known each other for decades now, we went to see Friday the 13th Part 7, I think it is, A New Beginning, the one with the girl who has psychic powers.
Oh, God.
We went to see that in a movie theater in Voorhees, New Jersey, and we went at midnight, even though we were only around 14 or 15. We were staying at his mom's house, and his mom was, let's say, looser on the rules than my parents would have been. And we were in the movie theater, and it was full of drunk people. There was a broken bottle fight during the film where two guys got dragged away by police, and we were too stupid to know to leave. And while we were leaving the theater, walking through the parking lot, because Doug lived right around the corner from the mall, we got beaten up and mugged.
Oh, jeez.
By four guys. And our money was taken, and Doug got beaten up really bad, and I got punched around and kicked and stuff. And only by the sheer fact that we happened to stumble on a taxi cab at a light, which is very strange because there are not a lot of taxis in suburban New Jersey, that we might have even made it out, because they were actually chasing us for our lives at one point. And we got into a taxi cab, and the taxi brought us to Doug's house, and his mom was on the couch at like 3 a.m, and she sort of was like half asleep and watches us wander in and sees that we're bleeding.
Oh, God.
And she flips out. And the other part I can remember the most, and this is kind of a thing that reminds me of a Christmas story, is it's like 3 a.m, Doug's mom calls my dad. And has to gently lay it on him as to what's happened. And so she's like, you know, Mr. Kelly, I don't want to alarm you. Bob is fine. But him and Doug got mugged. And then I hear on the other end of the phone, So there was that. And then Doug and I had to spend the next week at school being told by our friends how we were a bunch of pussies. Had they been there, they would have taught those muggers a thing or two. So, yeah.
I think the moral of the story is that New Jersey is the worst. I think that might be the moral.
That's the moral of a lot of stories that I tell.
That is awful. That is just awful. Yeah.
So Friday the 13th is kind of a dubious series. But I want to end the show on an up note. So I will tell yet another story, but it is similar to yours in that it's happier, is that when I was a kid, I was probably about 9 or 10, I was being babysat by my cousin Dawn. Well, my parents went out, and we had just gotten cable, and we had this pay service called Prism, which was like a local kind of low-rent version of HBO, and Motel Hell was on, which is a movie about farmers that kill people and use them for their sausage, and it's a horror comedy, and I begged Dawn to let me watch it, even though it was rated R. I begged her, and she was like, no, you're too young, and I just kept being such an annoying little shit. And so she finally relented, and then I was utterly terrified. And so by the time my parents came home, they found their kid just completely terrified, and poor Dawn got in trouble. And so I completely threw her under the bus. So Dawn, if you're out there, I apologize for doing that to you. I didn't mean to do that.
It's interesting. Was that like the seed that eventually grew into Turn It Off with Tracy? Was that like the first moment when you were like –
Sean, I've never made that connection, but now that you say it, I may have to talk. Motel Hell might be – I don't know if I have enough guts to show it to Tracy. I don't know if I can get through it. I might be Turn It Off with Rob and then it's thinking.
Oh, I had Turn It Off with Tracy on my phone. I was listening to it, and I got into my car. My Bluetooth kicks on, and it comes over the radio. And my wife is in the car with me, and she's like, what are you listening to? What is this? I'm like, oh, it's this, you know, really funny show. And it's this guy and he does these shows I really like, but he does this one show with his wife. And my wife kind of launches in and like, well, that's nice. And how come you never asked me to do a podcast? And I go, oh, well, this show is actually him showing his wife horror movies to see how long she can last before she makes it and turn it off. And she's like, what kind of effed up show? And she went, I'm not even kidding you. She went on this giant diatribe about toxic masculinity the subjugation of women. And I was like, and I just let her go because I know well enough to know that, you know, I wasn't going to stop her when she started. And then I was like, no, it's not that at all. And you know, I had her listen to a little bit more of the show. And I don't know if I do end every show by saying like, I love, you know, you guys say you love each other. So she was like, oh, okay, that's sweet. I'm like, oh, that's sweet. Like I had to listen to a 20-minute toxic masculinity speech.
Oh no! I know your wife hates me now.
Oh, it was great. Well, no, and then when I told her today, I kind of put it in our shared calendar because we have a kid, and you know somebody had to be watching the kid. I was like, oh no, I can't. You know, I'm podcasting, I'm recording, I'm guesting on a show. And she's like, whose show? And I'm like, oh, interestingly, I'm like the guy that shows the horror movies to his wife. And she's like, oh, really? And she's like, let me guess, you guys are talking about some horror movie? And I go, well, actually.
Funny you say that.
Yeah. So you have a very, very interesting reputation in this household.
I appreciate that, I guess. I will send me your address so I can send a apology note to Mrs. Sean. I don't want to think badly of me. The whole show was Tracy's idea. I have to say, Tracy's idea. Yeah, I'm not forcing her to do anything.
That's so awesome.
Okay, all right. Well, yeah, that's going to do it for Friday the 13th. Generally on this show, I like to remain positive. We try to find movies that we like because I'm talking about old movies and I don't want to pick movies just to dump on them. But and I expected to kind of like Friday the 13th again because I was like, oh, it's an old horror movie. I like it. But yeah, this thing is just a snooze fest. But it was worth it to have you on, John, because I'm a fan of you. I'm a fan of your podcast. I like the Secret Wars. Anyone who dares to podcast about Secret Wars 2, that is a brave soul because, I mean, good Lord.
Yeah.
It was great talking to you, and I'm so glad I got to have you on. And like I said, apologies to your wife. I feel really, really terrible. But anyway, where can people find you on the internet?
So you can find me on Twitter at Sean, it's SEAN42AZ. You can find the Marvel Superhero Secret Wars and Beyond podcast on the Pulp to Pixel podcast network. I co-host with Greg Arujo, who I know has been on the show and is generally good guy. I think he did Buck Rogers with you. And he and I were comparing the horror of the Buck Rogers dance scene to most of Friday the 13th. So each of us got our own little snippets of hell in our movies. and so you can find at Pulp to Pixel at blog.blogspot.com. And yeah, I'd love to hear from people. And thank you so much for having me on the show, man. I'm a big fan of the show. I have to tell you, the secretary episode was really, really profound to somebody who has a child and to have somebody who specializes in talking about sex ed. And that was really interesting. And then when you guys covered Magnolia, I just like, I think I literally tweeted you guys like 10 times within an hour of posting that show. And I didn't mean to stalk you, but I am a huge fan of that movie and your guys' ability to analyze it was amazing. So great show. And I'm glad I could be a part of it. And I'm glad that I got to revisit some childhood trauma and find some closure. So I appreciate that.
You're welcome. I'm glad I could help with this therapy session. I appreciate it. But yeah, thank you very much. That's all very, very kind words. And yeah, the secretary one was a lot of fun. I love Kim, and she was a great guest. So it was great to have her on. So again, thanks everybody for listening. If you feel differently about Friday the 13th, please let us know on the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're always talking about movies on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. So thanks everybody for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Is anyone else alive? Are they all dead?
Yes, ma'am. Two of my men pulled you out of the lake. We thought you were dead, too. Do you remember very much?
The boy. Is he dead, too?
Who?
The boy, Jason.
Jason?
In the lake. The one who attacked me. The one who pulled me underneath the water.
Ma'am, we didn't find any boy.
Then he's still there.